my feeling about illustration is I don't have a favorite illustration. There's many that I feel good about. There's far more that I feel bad about. But I'm always looking, I always say my favorite cover, my favorite illustration is the one that I do tomorrow, is the one that I look forward to.
Hey everyone, this is Julie Wake from the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Welcome to season 6 of the Creative Exchange podcast. We continue our celebration of artists, arts leaders, and the brilliant minds shaping the creative landscape. From painters to performers, writers to visionaries, we delve into the diverse world of creativity to discover what it truly means to be an artist in today's dynamic and ever-evolving landscape. I hope you'll join me on this creative journey. And if you like these conversations, leave a rating or a review. Share with a friend. Help us shine a bright light on our creative corner of the world here on Cape Cod. We'd like to thank our sponsor, William Ravis Real Estate, as the official real estate company of the Arts Foundation. We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Cape Cod Melody Tent, the Kelly Foundation, the Woods Hole Foundation, and the Cape Cod Foundation. We couldn't do it without your support. We'd like to thank Bank 5 and the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod. Thank you for supporting the arts. Greetings, everyone. We are thrilled to bring you an incredible interview with one of the nation's most prolific illustrators, Bob Stack. Bob's illustrious career has seen him working with many renowned clients, including The New Yorker, Time, McDonald's, Vanity Fair, Amtrak, American Express, Sony, United Airlines, Nickelodeon, and many, many more, which you can find listed in our show notes. If you're not already familiar with Bob's name, you will undoubtedly recognize his work. His art has graced numerous covers of The New Yorker magazine, with his iconic November 17th, 2008 cover titled Reflection in celebration of Barack Obama's historic election as the nation's first African-American president, earning the coveted title of Time's number one top magazine cover of 2008. Time praised it as beautifully rendered and simply spectacular. In fact, it remains the most popular New Yorker cover of all time, according to the New York store, NewYorkerStore.com. Bob Stack is not just an illustrator, he's an artist with an unwavering passion for creation. Even after over 50 years in the field, he continues to inspire. He embodies qualities like optimism, collaboration, risk-taking, adaptability, and an easygoing nature that makes him a pleasure to work with. Prepare to be inspired as we dive into a captivating conversation with the remarkable Bob Stack. We're in Chatham, Bob's studio. And we are prepared to have a conversation with Bob Stack. Thank you so much for having us in the studio today in downtown Chatham.
Thanks, Julie.
I want to start this conversation. I'm really enjoying this process of asking people to respond quickly, like a quick hits type of thing. I'm going to say a couple of words and then you respond.
Okay.
Cats or dogs?
Definitely cats.
Who would play you in a movie?
You know, a lot of people, they used to tell me, I reminded them of Bill Murray, and I never knew if that was a compliment or not, you know? So I would say Bill Murray.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Your superpower?
The ability to meet deadlines.
Oh.
Never miss a deadline.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good one. First concert?
Oh, gosh. It might have been Peter Frampton back in 76 or something. Probably. Notable concert. Concert I remembered. Okay. Concert I remembered when I got in. When I left, I forgot all about it.
Yeah.
Or Springsteen.
Yeah. Okay. Guilty pleasure.
Doritos. Spicier the better.
Yeah. I love it. So that's fascinating to kind of hear some of these quick hits. And what I'd like to know now is, where did you grow up? What was it like being you as a kid?
I grew up in Los Angeles, in Redondo Beach. My parents were immigrants after the war from Germany and Poland. My father worked in aerospace in Los Angeles, as everybody did. You know, as a kid, I always, you know how your father had a, everybody's father had a Super 8 camera and they'd have films and stuff like that. Mm. Kids doing cartwheels or, you know, jumping jacks or whatever for the camera. I'd always run up holding a coloring book page, you know, like this is really exciting. I colored this, you know. So as a kid, I always wanted to be an artist. I was always, you know, the quote unquote, you can't see air quotes in audio, but I was always the best artist in the class. So, which I always had a problem with because that was all. So where do the other kids go with that? You know, where does the second best artist go with that? Where does the third best go? So what happens is teachers, by no fault of their own, they tend to focus on that, not realizing that kind of shuts down everyone else in the classroom. You know, it's like, well, you know, the best basketball player has been determined. The best artist has been determined. The math whiz has been determined. Where the hell do I go with this? So, you know, I was a very precocious kid. So that's where my interest in art began.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I have I'm raising a daughter who is an artist and sent her away to camp last summer. And I asked her what she learned because she is kind of the best artist here, like within her little peer group. And she said, I learned I'm not the best. And I thought that was an interesting.
Well, that's good. That's actually really good for her.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was kind of the same way as a kid because I remember, you know, when you'd have like art fairs at school or whatever, the fifth grade art fair or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was a real big procrastinator as a kid. I got over that once I became a freelance illustrator. But so like the day before the art show, I'd, you know, do a painting of the Capitol of in Sacramento, the Capitol building or something like that. And it would be lame. And it would be in the show and it would get like third place or an honorable mention or something like that. And friends of mine, they would get like first place because, you know, they worked on their piece. I was like, oh, I'll just go ahead and whip something out. And it was just terrible. But that was good for me because I learned that, well, there's other kids who are working harder, who may have to work harder at this, and they're taking it seriously. And so that was a real motivator for me. As a kid, you know, I had to go beyond, you know, being able to draw Fred Flintstone or something like that.
Right.
You know, I need to know what light does. Mm. What I need to understand composition. I need to do the things that you're supposed to do as an artist.
Yeah. Do you think were you born with the talent, or do you think?
Yeah, I think I definitely was. I mean, I was always that kid who. Like I said, was always coloring, always drawing. My brother was and still is a hemophiliac, so he required an awful lot of attention from my parents. So I was forced to entertain myself. I was, I just had one brother, and so his needs were always the primary concern of my parents. So I was left to kind of figure things out on my own. And in many ways, it was... you know, it's a sad story of a kid growing up, but in many ways it was instrumental in the artist I became.
Yeah.
Because I learned to take care of myself. I learned to depend on myself, to entertain myself, that, you know, I never took a art class past high school. Okay, I didn't go to art school. I double majored in print journalism and international relations at USC, the most non-art curriculum you could imagine, because I always knew that the art would take care of itself. I'd figure that out, you know, which is completely different than the path that most illustrators take. But mine was absolutely the opposite of that.
So tell me more about art would take care of itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, I always had a strong desire to create. It's the most important thing. It still is to this day. It was the most important thing, the most driving factor in my life, the need to create. So it's not art, it's the need to create. And that can be in many different forms, as we all know. So I always knew that as long as I had that, well, it didn't matter. I would always be able to self-motivate.
Yeah.
I'd have no choice.
Yeah.
You know, I could be walking down the street and looking at a manhole cover, and all of a sudden, I'm looking at every manhole cover that I see, and my friends are saying, "What the hell is with you in the manhole covers?" I go, "I find them interesting. I think they're really pretty looking. You know, I think the design is really cool." So I was never, I never felt the need to get tutelage or instruction from art teachers or professors or that sort of thing, that I would figure it out.
Yeah, that you had like this drive to learn on your own, like self-driven.
Yeah, drive is, creative drive is what I always had.
Yeah.
And still do.
And then you were curious beyond the arts.
Curiosity is absolutely crucial. You know, when I look back on my success as a illustrator and a self-employed artist for close to 50 years now, the common denominator has always been curiosity, has always been the innate need to push myself. I remember I used to, back in the, probably the early 90s, I was that guy who, you know, you'd pick up a cereal box in a market and it would have that, you know, the crazy game scene on the back, you know, all this craziness and stuff like that. I did those type of drawings and for magazines and stuff like that. And I remember looking at a big crazy crowd scene that I did for Sports Illustrated for Kids. And I realized everyone is looking in this crowd. Everyone is looking to the left. These 300 people, you know, 280 of them are all looking to the left. Why is that? Well, I'm right-handed, so it's a lot easier to go ahead and draw the nose going to the left. And I thought, well, that's not good. That's kind of, you know, that's something I have to break that habit. I have to force myself out of that. So then the next illustration I got, a big crowd scene, I made sure that everyone was looking to the right. I didn't have to. It wouldn't matter to anybody other than me. It wouldn't matter to an art director. It wouldn't matter to an editor. But it mattered to me to be able to prove to myself that I could do that. And I could force myself out of this comfort zone that I had. Because that's one of the worst things that can happen to a successful illustrator is getting fat on your style, on your approach, your aesthetic, your problem-solving abilities to where they just become rote. They become so automatic that, you know, you're not really pushing yourself to the next level. So conceptually or aesthetically, that was something that luckily I had that in me to force myself out of that coziness, to have some sort of angst or a problem to solve, you know?
Right. So interesting. As you were talking, I was trying to think about drawing the lines of a profile because I'm right-handed to the right, and it was really hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. That's so interesting. So totally self-driven, but did you have mentors or coaches along the way?
Yeah, yeah. I was very fortunate in high school. I became, the school newspaper needed a cartoonist, and the newspaper advisor went to the art department and asked my art teacher said, you know, who can we get as a cartoonist? He said, well, you have to get Stack. And it's like, they talked to me and I said, okay, all right, fine. So I became the cartoonist for the paper. And then, I mean, it was just like everything. I mean, I was doing these controversial cartoons and everything that, you know, I was getting censored by the principal, and, you know, they're canning my cartoons and stuff. And it was a big thing where I got a lot of notoriety for that, because that was just at a point when administrations were violating the First Amendment rights of high school and college students, high school and college journalists. And that's what I interned in. My internship in 1977, when I was a sophomore at USC in print journalism, I went to DC and I was a intern with Robert F. Kennedy Memorial, studying student press rights for the Student Press Law Center. And that was just a very prestigious thing to do, but very unusual for an artist to be doing that. So in high school, I had teachers who were always, mainly the entire English department, very, very supportive of me and really cutting me slack like crazy. All of my teachers did, the ones that knew that, well, Stack's going to be an artist. You know, let's let him slide on business math because he really sucks. Right. He sucks at math. So I had the high school cross-country coach saying, Stack, you know, he taught business math. How long would it take you to do caricatures of the entire cross-country team? And I said, well, how many months is business math? And he said, it's 3 months. I said, it would take about 3 months. He said, okay, then you go into the break room over here and you just draw them for it. It's like a terrible thing to do. You know, my wife says, I can't believe they did that to you. It's like, no, I'm fine. I can add, I can subtract, I can divide. I don't need to know algebra. I don't need to know, you know, all this sort of advanced stuff. But so there was a lot of wink and a nod with teachers when I was a kid. I was fortunate growing up in a big city like Los Angeles. The editorial cartoonist, political cartoonist for the Los Angeles Times, a man named Paul Conrad, who had won 3 Pulitzers, he became my mentor. And so he was instrumental in getting me a full scholarship to USC, I was kind of his protege. Yeah. When I left USC in 1980, this is after Watergate, and all of a sudden you went from having 125 political cartoonists on 125 newspapers around the country to 250. So all of a sudden it was a game of musical chairs, and all those spots were filled up, you know, to be this kid who was trained as a political cartoonist, who didn't just fall into it, there was no room. So I started illustrating. And so I really, my illustration career pretty much took off in about 1984.
With what?
Well, stuff before then, I can tell you my first job was, my first paid job was with the National Football League, and I was 18. That came about because the local newspaper, I would take sports cartoons to them. I'd walk up the street and I'd take a sports cartoon to them, and they were publishing these things by the 16-year-old kid, and I was just amazed, you know. So the publisher of the National Football League programs calls up my house and says, can I speak to Bob Stack? And I said, I'm Bob. And he said, no, I mean your dad. And and I said, my dad's name is Al. You know, we had the two worst names for men in my family, Al and Bob, you know, sound like dopes. And I said, you must mean my dad, Al. And he said, no, I'm talking about the cartoonist and one who draws. I said, oh, that's me. So he said, now he should have, he said, how old are you? I said, 18. He should have hung up. But he said, okay, I may have an assignment for you. Come on down to Wilshire Boulevard to our offices. And that was like in a couple of days. And I went down there and I met him and stuff. And they assigned me a article in the National Football League programs, an article to illustrate. It was like 4 illustrations. They paid me $400, the most money I'd ever seen as a kid.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that was my first job.
Yeah.
But it's a great tribute to Dave Boss, who was a publisher of the National Football League programs. He, too, was a painter. that, you know, he didn't go ahead and just, you know, say, oh, forget it, kid, you know. So once I did that job, then I was just hooked.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, because you could make money.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can actually pay your bills.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the different, you work in all different mediums. We know you very well as an illustrator, but you also are a painter, sculptor. I see mobiles all around. You're a writer. Tell us about, like, do you bump from project to project, or are you very kind of, okay, I know you're working on a book now, so you're totally focused on the book, or are you able to, like, go out and garden, or, like, how do you find the day-to-day motivation?
Well, motivation isn't an issue with me. I mean, I was at it. There was a period maybe about, 8 years ago or so where I was doing, you know, 4 or 5 children's books a year, which is just ridiculous on top of doing New Yorker covers or illustration work or whatever. I mean, it was just way too much. I mean, now I'm at the point where if I do one children's book a year, that's enough for me. And I'm in the middle of doing one for Random House right now, a wordless picture book. You know, I don't know. I mean, I just that's part of my curiosity. I've always bounced from this thing to that thing to, you know, you have to understand that, you know, I work alone in this little studio in complete isolation. Okay. I have to find ways to entertain myself, to compel myself to get out of bed in the morning, you know, to get into the studio. So the way I do that is when I go to bed at night, you know, I'm working on a spread for a picture book or an illustration, and I go to bed, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's going to be really exciting to get up in the morning because I get to draw that locomotive, that old locomotive, and, you know, it's got the steam coming at the side, and it's got that cattle catcher on the front, and those are fun to draw, and I get to draw the smoke billowing out of the smokestack and stuff.
Yeah.
So I get really excited about that, so I leave myself with something really exciting to do the next day, knowing that, well, if I'm excited about waking up in the morning, chances are I won't die tonight. You know, I mean, you know, this is the way, you can't kill me off tonight. I got to draw the locomotive tomorrow.
Right, right. You live in your best life.
Yeah. So there's all, you know, but a lot of times, I mean, it's to challenge myself. I mean, the book that I'm doing right now, it's a wordless picture book. That's a real challenge because you're writing, even though there aren't words in it, you're writing. And I did a wordless picture book maybe about, 12 years ago. No, maybe about 10 years ago. I did a wordless picture book called Bluebird. And I had challenged myself to do it. I thought, you know, I wonder if I can do a book where the art tells the entire story. And it was it remains one of my most critically acclaimed books. For me, the ideal assignment is when a client calls up, an art director, an editor, or a creative director calls up and asks me to do something I've never done before. You know, like, you know, a couple weeks ago, I got a call from Paris to design a label for a chocolate bar, you know.
Mm.
Maybe before that, it's an assignment to do, you know, it's a New Yorker cover on some world event. You know, things that you don't have any control over. I mean, things that just like, you know, they just kind of occur and they present opportunities to express myself visually. That's an exciting place to be at. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, there's so much that I just turned down now that I just don't have interest in it. I don't have the need to do it. So, you know, I'll just turn down an assignment, a project, if it doesn't really interest me. And of course, the moment you turn it down, then they really want you. They want you to know why you're turning it down. And I get this perverse pleasure out of saying, because it just doesn't interest me, you know?
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Because, you know, it's a...
I don't have to do that anymore.
It's a lame advertising project. And you may be stuck doing this thing, but I don't have to do it, you know? So,
yeah.
Good luck, you know, but so that's a nice position to be in.
Oh, I bet. That's the dream.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the New Yorker covers. They're absolutely incredible. I'm so curious about, and I know you've been asked this a million times, but like just the process of what does that look like when the New Yorker calls you, and or do they put something out that says we're doing something on, you know, I'm going to mention the Obama cover in 2008, you know, are they looking for submissions or are they like, hey, Stack, we need something for the cover to celebrate the Obama administration?
Well, you're definitely on the right track. that's basically how it works. There's two ways that the New Yorker works, and that is where they come to you saying, we have a need.
Okay.
And the other option being self-directed cover submissions. So you have to understand that a self-directed, I'll do that first because it's easiest. A self-directed cover would be me doing a cover, oh, I don't know, something that's probably not a news event or timely, but what we call an evergreen or a potboiler that could be used at any point, a summer-oriented cover.
Okay.
Holiday. Baseball season's coming up, a baseball cover.
Okay.
Okay. And you'll get a list from the New Yorker as a reminder. It'll you know, every year in January we get this list saying, you know, we have on this, you know, Arbor Day, Martin Luther King's birthday, Valentine's Day, wedding issue, money issue. They'll list all the special issues, Thanksgiving, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you'll have that as a reminder of the topics that you should be dealing with. And everybody knows that, you know, we're all dealing with the same calendar. So everybody's kind of hitting on those things. I don't have much time to do that sort of stuff. Whenever I see a New Yorker cover on, you know, Arbor Day or something like that, I go, oh, here's the guy who's looking at the list, you know, more power to him. I should be reading the damn list, you know. But on assignment or, you know, we have a need is really that Obama cover is a perfect example. That was in 2008 when Obama had won the presidency and the New Yorker had gone out to all the artists and said, you know, we need an Obama victory cover since he won. And I just thought, I wrote back and I said, I thought for sure you'd have a cover on this in the can. I didn't even bother with it. No. We need that. So it's like, okay. So I sat down and I came up with, you know, a number of sketches. And for any topic, I may come up with 4, 6, 8, 10 different sketches in very rough shape, in very rough form, some in rough shape, and would submit those to the New Yorker saying, you know, here's a number of approaches. But I came up with this idea of the Lincoln Memorial at night with the reflection on the reflection pond. And also it was at the time of the year in that November where there was a full moon, this big round moon. And so I came up with this idea of the Lincoln Memorial, the reflection on the pond, and then the ubiquitous O for the Obama campaign in the New Yorker masthead, very somber. And I submitted that as a sketch, and they said, within 15 minutes, they said, that's the cover. You've got till late in the morning to have the entire thing done. And I thought, okay. But the thing is, when you look at that piece, that's the most non-Bob Stack piece of art. It's definitely my most famous piece of art.
Yeah.
But it's the most non-Bob Stack piece of art ever because it's a hyper-realist rendition of the Lincoln Memorial, the bars, the reflection on the pond representing the bars of slavery going up into Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation and the O for the Obama campaign. And the cover is called Reflection. I had to figure out how to draw how to paint digitally a hyper realistic view of the Lincoln Memorial. So, you know, that's again a challenge, but that's a deadline oriented challenge. If I don't make this deadline, if I don't figure it out in a few hours, I don't get paid. It's not the cover. Okay.
Right.
So you figure it out. luckily, you know, I have, you know, decades of experience with deadlines and figuring out problems visually that I could pull that thing off. I am proud that it is the most popular cover for the New Yorker ever, that it's remembered. But it came about very, very quickly. There is other covers that I've done for the New Yorker where they were done. I mean, the singer Prince died. They wanted a cover, and I came up with just a purple background with purple rain coming down. And they said, that's the cover. That probably took me 10 minutes. 10 minutes later, it was live on the New Yorker website. We got such a jump. And that's the key in journalism. I mean, you know, that's a timely cover. And we pulled it off in record time. You know, I have artist friends and illustrator friends who say, how can you do that? You know, how can you draw under that pressure? How can you, you know, perform like that when, you know, you're being told you only have a few hours to, it's like, what are you talking about? This is my job, you know? Yeah. I can't wait for, you know, the right northern light to hit me. I can't wait for my muse to walk in here. I can't, you know, I can't sit here and, you know, sharpen my pencils over and over and over because I'm too scared to put a line on a piece of paper. I've got to create a piece of art, and I've got to create it within a certain period of time. That's my job. So, you know, I thrive at that. I thrive on deadline. To me, it's there's no better motivator.
Right.
You know? Just isn't.
No, the fear of failure.
Yeah.
And you don't suffer from analysis paralysis, or there's just no time for that?
There's no time for that. I mean, it's no different than, you know, when as a kid, I've been in this business long enough that, you know, this is pre-internet stuff. So, like, if you were a political cartoonist or an editorial cartoonist back in 1975, and you weren't working at a newspaper that would have a reference department, if you needed to draw the Statue of Liberty, you'd call the reference department at the Los Angeles Times, and you'd say, I need some photos of the Statue of Liberty. And she'd come up, and she'd lay a folder there, and you'd go through them, and you'd have all this scrap reference to draw from.
Yeah.
Well, for me, I had to assemble that stuff myself. I thought, where am I going to have to draw Henry Kissinger? Yeah, I better clip all those photos and put them in a file for Henry Kissinger, for Nixon, a ocean liner. Am I going to have to draw that? You know, we didn't have the internet.
Right.
Okay. And if you had to draw that stuff on deadline, you'd have to go to a library and you'd have to look at reference stuff, and you'd have to look at books on, you know, what does a aircraft carrier look like? How is that shaped? You'd have to find a photograph. Well, I got to the point where it's like, that took too much time. So now I would say ever since 1975, I would draw from memory. And I'm fortunate that I have what is called a photographic memory. If I have to draw Statue of Liberty now, I would draw a passable Statue of Liberty because I know that she has 7 points in her crown. I know that that the cross, the torch is in her right hand. I know that the flame trails behind her. I know that she's holding a tablet in her left arm. I know how that's shaped with a cornice on top. I know what sleeves do. I know where her foot is in the front. I know where her foot is in the back. I know what the pedestal looks like. But the fact that I would draw that in a humorous way, if I get it wrong, that's fine. Does it read as the Statue of Liberty? Well, if it does, then I've done my job, you know, because I've communicated that to the viewer who looks at that and says, that's the Statue of Liberty. It's a shorthand that any intelligent artist or visual communicator uses. There are hieroglyphs that are meant to signify a concept, a noun, an object, and the reader can easily identify it. If I had to draw a 1920 Singer sewing machine right now, I could fake it pretty well.
Yeah.
And to me, that's where the art comes in, because I may make the bobbin look really weird, or I know that they have like kind of this wheel on the back, but I'd get the general concept of what
what it looks like.
Yeah, right, exactly. Without having to go to reference.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
Talk about going off on a tangent.
No, it's so interesting.
We talked at the beginning about ADHD. That's a perfect example of it. I don't know what the hell you asked me.
I'm on the ride with you. I'm like, oh, yeah. Do you have a favorite cover?
No.
I knew you were going to say no.
Only because you know, every cover that you do, you have to understand they're never 100% me.
Right.
They're art directed. They're edited. There are certain concessions that you make as an artist or certain things that you change or whatever. So it's never, you know, I have done New Yorker covers that I think are really terrific and brilliant that either were killed, paid for and never ran, or just not bought. I have that all the time. I do a slide presentation about that, New Yorker covers that never made it, which is fun to do. I did that at the Cape Cod Museum of Art a couple times during my retrospective.
Okay.
But no, my feeling about illustration is I don't have a favorite illustration. There's many that I feel good about. There's far more that I feel bad about. But I'm always looking, I always say my favorite cover, my favorite illustration is the one that I do tomorrow, is the one that I look forward to. Because, you know, I theoretically, I'm taking decades of experience and deadlines, and that suits me to be able to do something even better tomorrow. I mean, if I'm not doing something better tomorrow, then what's the point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've never been one of those illustrators who, you know, you look at certain illustrators, and I won't name them, but it's the same crap over and over and over. And they've done that for, you know, for a 50-year career, successful at doing that. It would drive me nuts. It would drive me crazy because it's become so predictable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Obama cover that you mentioned, Reflection, you know, I could have, that cover would have never worked if it was cartoonish or humorous in any way, shape, or form. The fact that I'm known as a humorous illustrator, if I can't do that cover as a hyper-realistic rendition of the Lincoln Memorial, it's going to fall flat on its face. So therefore, I have to be able to work that way in a realistic way.
Yeah. I'm really interested in, you just mentioned that you've done presentations on New Yorker covers that didn't. So we're talking about rejection there. I love the way you phrased it because you're like, oh, it's really fun to talk about the ones that didn't get chosen. How come that's fun for you?
Well, that's part of the job. I mean, you know, it's it doesn't mean that they're not great ideas. It may mean that they're politically incorrect. That they're not right for the New Yorker.
Yeah.
I did a cover. It was for the wedding issue showing, and I understand this is audio, so I'll try and paint a picture. Wedding issue, and I had the inside of a bakery, and there's two big cakes in the window, and one has a traditional bride and groom on top of it, and the other cake has these two hot lesbians. And the two lesbians are kind of hugging and they're canoodling. I think that's the word. And the groom on the heterosexual cake is just, his tongue's hanging out. He's leering, just looking at the lesbians. And the bride is just kind of holding him back by his collar going, you know, here he goes again. And every time I show this thing, every time I show this thing at a talk, the crowd goes crazy.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
I did this talk with Francoise Mouly, the art director for The New Yorker, and David Remnick, the editor, and Barry Blitt, another cover artist. And the crowd went crazy. And I said, yeah, David, why didn't we run this? And David said, Bob, we're The New Yorker. We're not the Howard Stern show. You know, so doesn't mean it's not a great cover. But
right.
But maybe not right for the New Yorker
in that moment.
But you know, rejection is that's part of the game. I mean, anytime I'm up for a cover and I submit a number of ideas, you know, I'd like to get the cover. There's times when I've submitted an idea that I think, oh, please don't pick that one because I don't want to do that cover for a variety of reasons. And if I don't get it, it's like, okay, I live to fight the good fight another day.
Yeah.
That's the way I was trained as a journalist, okay? Artists don't feel that way. Most artists don't feel that way because they will get fixed on one idea that they submitted and they think it's the greatest thing on the face of the planet. But, you know, there are a variety of reasons why when the New Yorker is looking at 100 different ideas for a cover that their piece did not run. I know cover artists for the New Yorker that submitted covers for certain events, and when they didn't get the cover, they just said, that's it, I'm never going to submit to the New Yorker again. And I just thought, boy, are you in the wrong business? You know, this is how journalism works. You know, you give it your best shot, and if you don't make it, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you go back to the drawing board the next day.
I love that. I'd like to talk a little bit about, we're kind of in the same area here of, you posted something on your Instagram, which I love, your Instagram site. It's really kind of funny. You're very honest about being a fly on the wall in the museum. You just recently had an exhibit at the Cape Cod Museum of Art, which was amazing and very successful event, and the feedback was incredible. We were able to bring some of our donors to that and really enjoyed ourselves kind of getting into your mind and seeing the work laid out in a retrospective, which I want to talk about too. But being a fly on the wall and overhearing people, why did you do that? That's really funny and interesting to me. Like, what did
Well, it would be like if I had to give a talk or something like that, it's like I'll hang out in the gallery for a while and, you know, and just kind of look at stuff. See, it's like, has anything gotten ripped off yet? You know, I mean, I had so many small things that I thought, surely something's going to be, nothing was ever gone. But, you know, you start listening to people and everyone, you know, it was an interesting show in that it wasn't a boring show. It was like people went to the show and they were smiling. They were laughing. They were, their jaws were dropping. They were saying to their friend, they said, did you see this thing over here? No, I haven't. But have you seen this thing over here? You got to see this. You know, so people had reactions. And that's what I really loved. I just hate gallery shows, museum shows, where you go in, they've got the 20 paintings of the artist on the wall. They're not memorable whatsoever. They engender no emotion whatsoever. You don't feel this connection at all. And, you know, you're in there for 5 minutes and it's like, okay, you know, I saw it all. You know, I mean, what I liked about hanging out at in the museum was I would talk to somebody that I was there to talk to. And then all of a sudden somebody realized, or I'd hear them say, that's Bob right there. That's Bob Stack. And then they would kind of hang around while I'm talking to this other person. And then everybody was hanging around. And then they were asking me questions about stuff. And I was more than happy to explain to them about, you know, about all the art and stuff. But it was really interesting to me to the universal comments from people were like, this show is so delightful. It really hits me. It brings back memories of my childhood. It appeals to kids. It appeals to adults. It just kind of had that that sort of aesthetic to it. That it was a show that people genuinely smiled and enjoyed. And I knew it would be that type of show. It's just a pain to put it all together.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, you got to keep in mind that in my case, I'm not that I do so much work that it's like, I mean, that show was maybe 1/3 of 1% of, you know, my life's work. I realized it's not going to be a retrospective because there's huge portions of my life that are not represented in there. All I could do was show people the diversity of my work and give them a taste of what I did, what I do. But you know, I had to go ahead and I don't finish painting and then have it framed and have it ready to go. It goes in a cabinet or something like that. And it's like, if somebody wants to see it, it's like, oh, now I got to frame the thing. Well, in terms of working digitally, you know, I have to select the piece. I have to print a giclée. I have to get a frame for it. I have to mat it. I have to put the whole thing together. And then I got to do that over and over and over and over until I assemble a show. So it was very, very labor intensive. But again, I didn't shy away from it. I only had 10 months to put the whole thing together, which is really short. I mean, you'd like to have 2 years.
Yeah.
But again, knowing that I met impossible deadlines before, I knew I would meet this deadline. So,
and why now? I know that Benton at the museum had asked, or other previous creative directors had asked you to do a show. And why did you wait so long?
Why did I turn them down at first?
Yeah.
Well, they came to me about 10 years ago, and I was just, and they met in the studio. It was not Benton. It was another director. And we talked, and, but I have always, I've never enjoyed the gallery or museum world, because it's a different world. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, it's presentation of artwork as opposed to me creating a piece of artwork and getting it onto that printed page. Those are completely different worlds. Okay. That was at a point about 10 years ago where I was insanely busy with my books, with illustration, with New Yorker covers, and a variety of things that I just didn't have the time. Mm-hmm. So I declined. But when Benton asked a year ago, around this time, I think, sat down with my agent and I, and we talked about it, and I had known him for some time, so I felt I did not know him very well, but I knew him, and I just felt comfortable with his what he was offering me, and
with Benton's vision,
with Benton, yeah, with his support, and so we said yes, and so got the whole thing together, and the experience was wonderful. I mean, at no point anything I asked for, he always said yes. I mean, it was just. I mean, in the final days, I said, you know, if you want to get to know me as an artist, you really have to get in my studio and you have to see all the tchotchkes and all the weird stuff all over the place. And I said, you know that shelf in the studio where, you know, it's one long shelf about 12 feet long, and it's got all these toys and weird vintage things on stuff like that. I said, what if we went ahead and recreated that in the studio? I said, you need to talk me out of this. And he said, no, I think that's a great idea. I said, no, you're supposed to talk me out of it. So we, you know, he said, we'll have the shelf built and all you do is take a photograph of it and then empty the stuff and then we'll reassemble it exactly the way it is. Well, we did that and everybody loved that,
loved it.
The show. Loved that part of the show. Yeah, he just never said no to anything. It was really kind of amazing to me.
Is there anything you want to try that you haven't tried yet?
Oh, I was thinking about this the other day. There was something I wanted to do.
I know, it's a tough question.
Yeah, I know, because the thing is, you know, when you look back on my career, it's like there's stuff that I've wanted to do that I either found a way to do or it kind of fell into my lap and I wound up doing it that way. There's things that I didn't know I ever wanted to do that were offered to me that I got to do. And it's like, oh, that was really cool. Boy, I don't know.
I can think of something that I would like you to do. And this is kind of, maybe we can put it out in the universe and it will happen, that a Democrat wins the next.
that would be, that's not good for New Yorker covers though. I mean, it's a lot easier when he can do anti-Trump cartoons, you know?
Right.
Well, I did a mobile for the show that was a large mobile, probably about 14 feet high by about 13 feet wide. That was really a blast to do. I had a blast doing that. I'd like to do more of that stuff.
It was stunning.
Yeah, I would like to do more of that. I mean, it was kind of a last minute thing because we had first thought about doing a mobile where it was like my cartoon, some of my children's book characters. And I thought, well, yeah, that would be nice, but let me make something, you know, really unexpected. So that's when I came up with that mobile right there. But I could have kept going on building those pieces and creating those pieces and just a celebration of color. So,
oh, for sure. It was stunning.
So that stuff is fun to do.
It almost, it brought the work to life.
Yeah.
Where you could walk around it, under it.
Yeah, because it moves. It's kinetic.
Yeah. I mean, it's great.
Every time you look at it, you get a different view.
Yes, yes. I saw your show with my son, and he kept pulling me throughout the museum.
That's great.
Looking at different things. And we really should have gone back a second time because it was like it wasn't enough time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was really fun. This has been really like just an honor to be in here and have your time. But before I let you go, is there anything I haven't asked you?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered absolutely everything.
I know. All my questions, I'm like, yeah, he answered that.
Yeah.
It's been a delight. Any words of wisdom to up and coming?
Stay curious. You know, just absolutely stay curious. It's the key to living in an artistic life. Always ask yourself, you know, what is this? Just keep your eyes open and just really see, you know, it's so important. And push yourself creatively. I mean, push yourself out of your comfort zone. If you paint right-handed, paint left-handed. You know, try something. That's it. You figure it out.
Hosted by Arts Foundation's Executive Director, Julie Wake, the series is an ode to the artistic process and its unique manifestation on Cape Cod and beyond. Thanks for listening.